I said at the start of this presentation that there remains a kind or form of illegitimate family, although just within the last couple of months, the territory on which that's legally true has shrunk dramatically. A year ago, I think there were somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 states where a same-sex couple could legally get a marriage license and have a wedding. That's up to 32 now, along with the District of Columbia. And it's just stunning how this sort of groundswell is occurring now. Texas is not on the list. Texas may be the last one on the list, if ever, in part because in 2005, even though in 2005 it was not legal for two people of the same sex to get a marriage license and have a wedding that was legally understood to be a marriage, it was not legal to do that. It wasn't then, it isn't now. In 2005, Texas doubled down by adding to that a constitutional amendment explicitly forbidding it. There's no way to get it, and yet now it's explicitly forbidden. So there's just sort of two levels on this. So the groundswell seems to be going in the other direction, and yet there's a great deal of energy still spent talking about this. So I want to talk about it for a little bit, both as someone that has been a sociologist for a long time, but also been a minister for even longer. So I want to give that point of view. Now, we learned a long time ago that dyads were the most unstable of all groups. We also learned that conflict theory teaches us about social inequality. Now, from a conflict point of view, we could address the same-sex marriage question almost as a no-brainer. This clearly violates the rights of a disenfranchised minority. They can't do, simply because they're different, what other people can do and what other people want to do, and in fact, what everybody else thinks is a good idea. All right? So from a conflict point of view, I mean, marriage is a good idea. From a conflict point of view, it's easy to argue in favor of same-sex marriage. But also, because we know that dyads are the most unstable of groups, and we've invented marriage to, in a sense, stabilize the sort of emotional drama that comes in with being in a close, intimate relationship, this is a good thing. It's a family value. Monogamy is a good idea. So the question is, why would we not extend this same benefit to anybody that wants it, even if they happen to both be men or both be women? It has been argued, and I think it's a fairly persuasive argument, that the proliferation of HIV and incidence of AIDS cases might have not been as high as it was had gay men had the opportunity to both be seen by others and to see themselves as monogamous, because it's spread through promiscuous sexual activity, among other things. That if the world of gay men had had this social support structure, we may have had fewer cases of HIV. I think that's an argument that's worth pondering a little bit. We do know that all of us, more or less, agree that marriage is a good idea, and the question is, why not for everybody? And in fact, the state of Texas, which still doesn't and maybe never will make this a part of what's legal, did in 2005 and even before that ratify and understand and make legally sound the adoptive relationship between two men and a child. Two men or two women could legally adopt a child and be both, and both of them could be seen as parents. So if you're going to do that, why not strengthen what we know strengthens families and let them get married? So I would argue that it's easy to go on that side of the room and say, from a conflict point of view, this is a civil rights issue. It's also, I think, a matter of social functionality. So as a sociologist and as a minister, and I'll get to that part in just a second, I've made a personal decision a long time ago. I decided that, and people come up to me a lot and say, will you marry us? And I generally say, well, thanks for the offer, I'm already married. But I'll stand and watch while you, if any two men or if any two women ever said to me, would you preside at our wedding, I would do it. I would have done it any time. I would do it now. I would have done it any time over the last couple of decades, really. At some peril, although less, there are ministers that get thrown out. They get defrocked in some places and in some denominations for doing this. Presbyterian Church is struggling with this one now. We're just about to rule, each little regional area in the country is about to rule on a decision that came out of the General Assembly this past summer that says, in fact, Presbyterian clergy, if they are standing in a state where it's legal to do it, because so many are now, are not constrained from presiding at weddings. Now, we have been for a long time, you know, and it in fact put your ordination credentials at risk, and I said, I don't care. You know, if anybody ever asked, I would do it anyhow. And that's still true. And although now it wouldn't make any sense to do it in Texas, we would just go to the nearest legal state and do that. You know, it'd be a nice little road trip for the minister involved. That'd be great. Okay, Mr. Smart Guy. I get that a lot. What about this stuff in the Bible? So let me just take my other hat and put it on for just a second here and talk about what is often the starting place for this debate for people for whom the sacred scriptures speak in ways that they regard as sacred and, you know, guide their lives in pretty much the way it says. The typical first point in the discussion is in Leviticus 18:22, where homosexuality is explicitly defined as an abomination unto the Lord. It says that. All the translations say that. Fair enough. The question is, what does that mean for us several thousand years later? I don't know. What else is an abomination unto the Lord? Let's look. Eating shellfish, Leviticus 11:10. I was thinking about a shrimp poor boy for lunch, but maybe not. Because eating shellfish is an abomination unto the Lord. It's in the Bible. Selling one's daughter into slavery, fairly common occurrence. Working on the Sabbath, punishable by death. Anybody got a job where they have to work on Sunday? Punishable by death. So also punishable by death are rebellious sons who are gluttons and drunks. They are to be killed. I mean, that's what it says. For all you frat guys, Deuteronomy 22:18. Rape victims. Victims who do not cry for help are to be killed. Presumably because help would come. And they've avoided that. Although a man who rapes a virgin may settle this with her father for cash. Deuteronomy 22 is full of this stuff. Raping a virgin in biblical times, in the ancient world, was not only an emotional trauma for the victim involved, but it also robbed her of any level of status or citizenship, and she didn't have much to begin with because she was no longer a virgin, right? The guy that did that in the Bible could make this right by paying off her dad. Now, study biblical archaeology, study the context of the ancient world, and you can gain an understanding of why all of this stuff made sense to them then. No problem with that. The question is, why do we lift out 1822, just as it is, fast forward to the 21st century, and drop it onto two guys or two women that want to get married in the same way? We don't do it with the other stuff. We understand it in context. We look at the nature of work, Sabbath, family, daughters, slavery. We look at that whole thing in an entirely different way. So why do we do it for everything else except that? That's an interesting question to me. What about the New Testament? Interestingly enough, Jesus of Nazareth in the New Testament never mentions homosexuality, not once, not ever. So what would Jesus do? Well, I don't know. We know that he is notoriously soft on sexual sinners. The woman at the well, the woman caught in adultery, which I think is sort of a weird story. They caught her in adultery. How'd they do that? Is there not a voyeurism problem with this? But anyway, he's notoriously soft on sexual sinners. The one to whom he directs his most fervent criticism are the religious ruling elite. I just think that's interesting. Now, there are three passages in the New Testament, and I can give you chapter and verse if you want them, that seem to talk about homosexuality. 1 Corinthians 6:9, 1 Timothy 1:8. And in both of those instances, the word that's used to describe homosexual behavior is most often translated pedophile or sodomite. The same sort of thing that happens when conquering armies rape, pillage, and plunder. So in two of the three passages in the New Testament where homosexuality is mentioned, or it's translated as same-sex behavior, it refers to pedophilia, it refers to humiliation after warfare, or in some way what we would now call a criminal act. So I think that needs to be understood. There is one passage, Romans 1:26 and 27, where I'll just read it from the translation that I had. For this reason, God gave them up to degrading passions. The women exchanged natural intercourse for unnatural, the same way also the men. They were consumed with passion for one another. And it seemed to be same-sex consuming passion. The overriding issue there, the nature of the sin as I understand it, is the turning of a person into a thing. That the thing, the sexual encounter, becomes overriding to the relationship. I understand that passage, and there are many New Testament scholars that would agree with me. I understand it in the same way that I understand the dream world piece, where music video makers turn people into things. I think the prohibition there is against turning a person into a thing, which two men or two women who wish to be married are not trying to do, at least any more so than a man and a woman who wish to get married might be trying to do. To put that into a broader context, you read other writings of the Apostle Paul in the New Testament, he seems much more concerned about the role of women in the church, which is certainly a debated topic now, but not unheard of for women to be ministers and so on. Oddly enough, using again the same lens that drew me to the conclusion that that piece in Romans is examining behavior more akin to the dream world, using that same lens of interpretation and scholarship, I would tell you that for his time and in the company of the people he was with, the Apostle Paul is a feminist. He's a feminist for his time. So all of that aside, in practical terms, let me leave you with this thought. I preached a sermon probably 10 years ago now. The title of the sermon was called Lunch with Jesus. Lunch with Jesus. And I want you to imagine, you don't even have to be Christian to do this. Everybody at least knows of the character of the man, Jesus of Nazareth, as he's written about in the New Testament. And we more or less know what he stood for and all that, peace and love and forgiveness and all that. Imagine you get to have lunch with this guy for 30 minutes. And during that time, he'll play Aladdin and the Lamp with you. You get to convince him to solve one social problem. And he will do it just because you said so. Are you really going to put on the table, for the one and only chance you get for Jesus of Nazareth, the crucified Lord, if you will, if that's your belief system, the Savior of the universe, are you going to bother him with two guys or two women that want to get married and love each other? Are you going to bother him with that? I wouldn't. And because it's Rick Perry Day, I want you to answer the question in a tweet. What would Jesus do? What problem would he solve if not that? And if you think that's the one, put it down. That's okay. What would Jesus do? Thank you very much. Oh, by the way, one other thing, and I need to say this for the recorder. I know that most of you don't agree with me, and that's fine by me. And the only reason I did this riff was to show you how someone who's been long trained and experienced as a sociologist, even longer trained and experienced as a minister, thinks through the topic. I've arrived at one conclusion. Take your own. What would Jesus do? What problem would he solve if you could have lunch with him for 30 minutes? What would you try to convince him to do? And for all I care, you can put same-sex marriage on it. It's just not something I would do. Thank you very much.